Stars Over Surrey with Dave Jamatis and John Extell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
In these days of the coronavirus, John and I are in separate places, both at home, but the show must go on. We're going to talk about the world of spaceflight and astronomy, constellation of the month, what to look for in the night sky next month. But first, what's happening in spaceflight and astronomy then, John?
Hello, Dave. Hello, everybody. The reason, of course, that we're not recording this in the studio is because of COVID-19. And that is having an effect in our area as well. So I thought I'd start off by talking about that. It's affecting aerospace companies quite considerably. In the past, they're a prime focus for financial investors. But now with the uncertainties about the worldwide future economy, much of those funds have dried up and companies are getting concerned. We've already seen the London-based company OneWeb file for bankruptcy just a month ago, only a few days after they'd launched another 34 of their broadband satellites. However, in mid-April, they have actually approached the UK government for a lifeline to see if they could be bailed out, promising to shift some of their operation over from Florida over to Britain if the UK government came up with some funds for them. The result of that is as yet unknown. Elsewhere, we'll have seen people producing face masks for health workers using 3D printing. That's been on the news, but both SpaceX and Blue Origin in America make extensive use of 3D printing and so have quite a lot of capacity. So they've diverted some of that into producing face masks for local hospitals and the American health system more generally. Virgin Orbit has been doing the sort of thing that McLaren and other UK racing car companies have been doing, and that's turning their engineering expertise into the production of ventilators. They're currently awaiting regulatory approval, but once that's been given, they plan to churn out 200 a week, which is quite something. I've also just heard, and I'm afraid this isn't reflected in the slides because it's just off the press, but it's affecting the Russians too, of course, and they've just announced that production of their Soyuz launcher has been halted as a result of coronavirus, so that could be quite serious. Now, as we're talking about Soyuz, that leads me on to my next topic, which is the comings and goings at the International Space Station. We've had just three people up on the ISS for a number of months, but that has been boosted back up to six, but only for a short while. But on April the 9th, the Soyuz delivered three crew members up to the ISS, and that's two Russian cosmonauts and one from NASA, an American astronaut. However, the three that had been up there for some while then returned to the to Earth from the ISS on the 17th of April. That's Andrew Morgan. It was his first flight, and he knocked up 272 days in orbit up on the ISS. Jessica Mayer, also from NASA, has returned in the same Soyuz with him. So she was up there for 205 days, as was from Roscosmos, Oleg Skripochka. Now, because of COVID-19, they won't just return to their families after debriefing as per normal. They're going to stay in quarantine for an extra fortnight as a precaution. The human immune system is apparently slightly depressed after a long stint in space, and these people have been up there for getting well over half a year, getting on for two-thirds of a year, so clearly they need to be protected. Another event up at the ISS, a Progress resupply vessel, was launched on the 25th of April using a Soyuz launcher, taking 3 tons of supplies and equipment needed up on the ISS. Now, there will be more crew and quite an important visit to the ISS, and that is by SpaceX for their very first mission with a manned spacecraft to the ISS. So NASA and SpaceX have agreed May the 27th. That's the launch date for what's known as Demo 2, the first manned flight of the Crew Dragon, and that will dock at the ISS a day later. And that will have 2 NASA astronauts on board. That's Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley, and both of those are veteran astronauts who worked on the shuttle. Now, they will stay and work on the ISS for 2 to 3 months and then return in the Crew Dragon for a splashdown off the coast of Florida in the Atlantic. Now, this will be the first manned launch from US soil since the space shuttle retired in 2011. And again, because of coronavirus, Jim Brindelstein, the director of NASA, has instructed the public, you must not travel to watch the launch. Although it'll be a momentous launch for America, you can't have people gathering in crowds. Now, that's the second test of the Crew Dragon. The first one was unmanned with the dummy on board. So this one is the second demonstration flight, will be followed by the first of the operational missions later this year. And that is called Crew 1. And the launch date for that hasn't yet been fixed, but later this year, and that will be a 6-month mission on board the space station. Initially we had 2 crew members, both NASA astronauts, allocated to that, but now NASA have allocated an extra astronaut, and also the Japanese space agency, JAXA, are also sending one of their astronauts who has already had 2 visits to the space station. And whilst we're talking SpaceX, they've been launching even more of their Starlink broadband satellites. Another 60 went up on the 23rd of April. So that's 420 of them that they've now got in their constellation. The Falcon 9 was the 4th time it flew, and that landed flawlessly on the drone recovery ship, slap bang in the centre of the target circle, landing circle. But that one was quite interesting for us because of the time of the launch. It meant that the Falcon 9 upper stage, together with the dispensing canister and the 60 satellites that had just been deployed, they passed over the south of England only 23 minutes after the launch, and presented a spectacular sight to the naked eye, shining much, much brighter than the planet Venus. I watched this and saw it through my binoculars, and through the binoculars you could see that it was a bar-shaped object. So that was the upper stage plus the dispensing canister. I could also see a few outlying tiny sparks. Now, these were the furthest, the first deployed of the Starlinks that had moved furthest out from the upper stage. They were very faint because their solar sails had yet to be deployed. But also some previously launched Starlinks have been making quite spectacular passes over the UK. And if our listeners are interested in seeing the Starlinks go over, then the website to look at is called heavens-above.com, and that predicts visible passes of these satellites and, of course, the International Space Station. If you do go onto this site, then please do remember, make sure that you enter at top right on the home page your location. Choose a location. Otherwise, it thinks you're not in Britain, but you're somewhere on the equator. So you'd get a different set of timings. Now, some more SpaceX news. SpaceX has just become the first commercial company to be contracted by NASA for launches of the uprated version of its Dragon cargo supply vessel. These are for trips to Gateway. I'm sure that listeners will remember me mentioning Gateway in the past. This is a sort of mini International Space Station, if you wish, that's going to be placed in orbit around the moon, and this is part of NASA's Artemis program, returning men to the moon, men and women to the moon, hopefully as early as 2024. And the idea of Gateway is that it will act as a way stop for future manned lunar landing missions. So this Dragon XL, which is an uprated version of its existing Dragon cargo vessel, which of course has been doing these logistical missions, resupply missions up to the International Space Station for several years. But the Dragon XL would be launched using not a Falcon 9, as with the ISS, but SpaceX's Falcon Heavy rocket. And it would be capable of ferrying 5 metric tons up to lunar orbit. The cargo would typically be sample return equipment, spacesuits for the crew for use on the lunar surface, and miscellaneous items needed both on board Gateway itself and also on the lunar surface. NASA say the first logistics mission like this could be as early as 2024. However, Gateway is thought likely to be delayed a little. Now, whilst we're also talking about the moon, listeners would be interested about a study that's just been done by European scientists. Now, we know that a leak in a spacesuit would be exceedingly dangerous, but we also use the word leak in a different sort of context, don't we? The reason for saying that is that this study has shown that human urea could in fact be a very useful additive in a process that uses lunar regolith, that's the soil on the moon, the dusty soil on the moon, for 3D printing of structures for any future base that we might build on the moon. Apparently, the urea would act as a very effective plasticizer. And this is something that keeps 3D printed structures workable. It keeps their strength and stability whilst the structures are hardening, having just been printed. And what I show on the slide that accompanies this talk is a little picture of an artist's impression of such a future moon base. Basically, it would be inflatable, habitable modules that are first built, and then surrounding those are these 3D printed sheaths, if you like, to protect them, and then regolith piled on top of that, adding yet another layer of protection. So quite an interesting little artist's concept there. A little further out from the International Space Station, of course, there is the Hubble Space Telescope, and that's been in the news over the last week or so, because it's now 30 years since the Hubble Space Telescope was launched. Now, listeners may well remember that initially it was a bit of an embarrassment to NASA, because it was found that the images wouldn't come to focus. There was, in fact, a problem in the manufacture of its primary mirror. And so NASA, I'm afraid, did become the butt of quite a few jokes about Hubble. However, some very brave astronauts corrected the problem on the very first Hubble servicing space shuttle flight. Effectively, what they did was, well, they added an instrument called COSTAR, and this was like putting a pair of spectacles on a myopic person to bring the images into perfect focus. And, of course, that was an astounding success. The Hubble has been maintained by four further servicing missions, all by the shuttle, and the last of these was in 2009. So how much longer can we expect Hubble to keep going? Some people think at least five, hopefully maybe even ten. The problem is with the gyroscopes that it uses for manoeuvring, for pointing. The very last of the servicing missions replaced all six of these gyros, and it needs three of the six to be operating for full accuracy. Now, in that time, three of them have failed, so there's no redundancy anymore. However, those three still seem to be doing a good job. It can operate with a reduced capability with just one, but it wouldn't be able to point for so long at an object. Hubble is still in tremendous demand. It apparently averages about 1,200 requests from researchers each year, but only 250 of those can be accommodated. So NASA and, well, the whole of the astronomical community have been celebrating this anniversary. The image that NASA have released, that as a special commemorative 30th anniversary image, is called Coral Reef. And I've included a copy of this in the slides that accompany this programme. And it shows an area of the Large Magellanic Cloud. Now, these are the large and the small Magellanic Clouds aren't visible from the UK. It's a southern hemisphere pair of objects. They're actually satellite galaxies of our Milky Way. About 160,000 light years away. So the coral reef, so called, because of the colours included there, show two objects, one a large red nebula called NGC 2014, and the next to it is a lovely smaller blue nebula called NGC 2020. So that's appropriate, 2020. So that's quite a stunning image as a birthday slide, if you wish. I've also included in the slide set my own personal favourite from Hubble. It's the Deep Field, or rather an enhancement of the Deep Field that NASA have called the Hubble Extreme Deep Field. And that's about 2 million seconds worth of exposure time and a very, very small area. Just 1/10 of the width of the moon, and that accounts for 30 millionths of the whole sky. Yet that tiny, tiny little patch contains 5,500 galaxies. And Hubble has been collecting that light from those galaxies over such a long period that 2 million seconds goes on for best part of a month, 25 days if I remember rightly. But that means it can collect light from extremely distant, extremely faint galaxies. Some of these are getting on for about 13 billion light years away. In other words, soon after, not that long after the Big Bang, when the first stars and the first galaxies were beginning to form. So what an incredible instrument. Little salutary thought, just to finish with, of course, is Hubble, wonderful instrument that it is. There are several other sorts of satellite with mirrors just as big as Hubble's that these ones point in. The KH-11 reconnaissance satellites operated by the US. Hubble was more or less, the mirror from Hubble more or less was a spare from this program, but it's done so much for us. In the last program, I mentioned that there was a comet called Comet Atlas that we hoped was going to become a naked eye object this month and would be quite a spectacle. What a big disappointment. And this so often seems to be the way with comets that we hope are going to be naked eye visible. At the start of April, it was realised that it had suddenly stopped brightening and was fading. And that seemed to indicate that the comet had broken up. But study of that was difficult from ground-based telescopes to see through the fuzz of the comet through to the actual nucleus. However, our Hubble has been called in and has studied the comet, and clearly the comet has been broken up. In the slides I include a copy of the photograph that Hubble has taken showing several, four, five, six or so little fragments, all that remains of what was once a nucleus of a comet. However, although it's a disappointment for amateur astronomers, for professional astronomers, it's actually very, very useful, because I think this is only the second time in about 30 years that they've had the opportunity of studying such a breakup, because this comet is one that didn't come from the Kuiper belt outside the orbit of Pluto, where a great number of comets come from. This one came from what we call the Oort cloud, a huge sphere of comets trillions of miles away that do occasionally get knocked out of their usual orbit and come in towards the centre of the solar system and go past the sun. So they at least are pleased. They will be learning a lot. Whilst we're talking about comets, I am pleased to say that another one has just been discovered. Again, just a few weeks ago in early April. This one is called Comet Swan, or more properly, Comet C2020F8. And that is showing early signs that this could well be a naked eye object visible in May. So if people are interested in that, I suggest you just Google Comet Swan during May and see what the latest news on that comet is. And websites will start to produce finder charts so you can know where to look for it in the night sky. However, it does look as though its trajectory means that it will be not far from the horizon in the UK, so not easily seen. But and there was, of course, another comet in the news some while ago, and that was comet now called 2I, Borisov. It was the an interstellar visitor, that a comet that has originated from outside our solar system, the first of those ever found, and the first and the second visitor, of course, to our solar system to be identified as such after Oumuamua, which seemed to be more like a shard of a broken up planet or an asteroid of some kind. Anyway, Borisov is now out of our solar system, or rather on its way out of our solar system. But of course has been continually studied ever since it was first discovered. NASA has just revealed that its SWIFT orbiting observatory, that's been up there for about 15 years or so, and originally was put up to study gamma ray bursts, but looks at other things as well. And that has been used to study the trail of Borisov, and the results indicate that Comet Borisov is rich in carbon monoxide, much richer than any of the solar system comets. So it's thought that means it didn't form within the solar system of a star like our Sun. More likely that will have formed in the most common sort of star in our galaxy, which is a red dwarf. There is, interestingly, one team of researchers who are thinking about a probe that could be launched to catch up with Borisov and study it. And they're putting forward proposals as to what kind of launcher, possibly the big space launch system, the one that NASA is developing to take a manned spacecraft back to the moon. But even if launched on such a vehicle, the probe wouldn't get to Borisov until 2045. So quite some time away. Speaking of asteroids, there's been a recent report that interested me quite a bit. Normally, asteroids live between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter in what we call the asteroid belt. But this particular set that I'm talking about live much further out. They live between the orbits of Jupiter and Neptune. So some of them will be between Saturn, Uranus, and so on. Now, these are unusual asteroids in the sense that they sometimes behave like comets, in that they will develop tails. So a little bit asteroid, a little bit comet-like. So that's why they're given the name of Centaur. Of course, a centaur was a sort of a halfway between a man and a horse. Now, a recent study of 19 of these has concluded that because of their very strange, highly inclined and unstable orbits, that they couldn't actually have arisen within the solar system. Their orbits can be explained if we go back in time and remember that the Sun, once formed, was actually part of a star cluster. The other stars in that cluster have moved away, but at the time the stars were close enough maybe to exchange. And so our centaurs came from another star. So quite an interesting study.
Thank you, John, for the update.
Stars over Surrey, constellation of the month.
So what is the constellation of the month then, John?
My constellation of the month for May is Leo. Leo, I think, is probably one of the most easily identifiable constellations after the Plough and Orion. Where to find it this time of the year? Well, as twilight starts to fall, Leo is about 50 degrees high, more or less in the south to southwest. And it's shaped, I always like to think of it, like the Sphinx, a lion sitting down with its feet outstretched in front. It's home to galaxies galore. Five of the brightest are Messier objects, but there's plenty of other interesting ones apart from those. It's also the home to some interesting double stars and also a nice variable star. I think it's probably a constellation best suited to a telescope so that you can pick up the galaxies, but a good power a full pair of binoculars will find those galaxies as long as you've got good clear skies.
The month ahead for Stars Over Surrey.
Well, let's start this What's Up session for May by thinking about what constellations we're going to find in the May night sky. As sunset happens and twilight starts, we'll be able to still see Orion just about sinking, starting to sink below the horizon. But you'll still see the bright stars of Betelgeuse at the top of left shoulder of Orion. That would be quite clear, and the belt just before it goes below the horizon. Moving around the ecliptic, we've got Gemini, nice and visible, and then my constellation of the month of Leo. Moving further into the south, we've got Bootis with the bright star Arcturus, and then we're starting to get some really good summer constellations to appear. We're getting Hercules, we're getting Lyra, and also Cygnus. The Plough will be more or less overhead as well for a good part of the month. So some fine constellations with some very interesting objects in them. Now, let's have a think about our nearest neighbour, the Moon. Well, the Moon starts off this month just a day past first quarter. It then, so very good for observing it. The full moon happens on the 7th. We move into the last quarter on the 14th, the new moon. Nothing in the way to stop you looking for those fainter deep sky objects like galaxies and nebula and so on. That will be on the 22nd. And then we're back to best time for moon watching, first quarter again, on the 30th. However, of course, the sun is rising earlier and setting later this month, so that means the nights are getting that much shorter. Gives us nice long days, however. So the sun rises at 5:34 on the 1st, but by the 31st it'll be rising at before 5 at 4:52. At the start of the month, the sun sets at 25 past 8, but by the end of the month, it's gone 9 o'clock before it sets, 21:08. Now, whilst we've got at least a few hours of darkness, let's think about what planets we can see. Venus, of course, is the brightest one, but we've got its near neighbour, Mercury, appearing again as an evening object. Not at the start of the month, but from the second week onwards. That's very, very low, below where you'll see Venus in the northwest. And best time to look would be about 40 minutes after sunset. However, that does improve. It climbs higher and sets later as the month draws on. And it will be reasonably bright. So it's a good thing to try and look for. Venus, as I've already mentioned, very, very clear. It's such a bright object in the western sky at the start of the month. By the month end, though, we'll be starting to lose it. It'll have dropped considerably lower and moved through to the northwest. Through a telescope, you'll see that its disk size will grow considerably during the month. But it's a rather thick crescent at the moment. By the end of the month, that will be a very, very thin crescent as it's lining up between us and the sun. Mars is a morning object, low in the east-southeast, but it's improving as the year goes by. And it'll be at magnitude zero, so reasonably bright for Mars towards the end of the month. Jupiter is a good morning object. It's there in the southeast in the pre-dawn skies, very bright at mag minus 2.4. By the month end, it'll be rising shortly after midnight. So it's getting easier for us to see. Saturn is also down there in the southeast, a little bit lower than Jupiter is, and not as bright, of course, magnitude plus 0.7. And it's to be found between Jupiter and Mars. But that's it for the solar system. Uranus and Neptune aren't visible this month. So let's see what the various days of the month might bring us. On the 7th, we've got a meteor shower, the Eta Aquarids meteor shower. So that's overnight on the 7th. Now, in theory, you might get 28 meteors from this shower an hour. But I'm afraid this time we've got a full, a fairly bright moon, so it's near full. So it's going to be washing out any of the fainter meteors. So the moon isn't favourable for a good display. Now, the moon, however, can help you to find your way to Jupiter, Saturn and Mars if you're up early over into the southeast in the pre-dawn sky on the 12th or the 13th, and you'll find the moon close, first of all, to Jupiter and Saturn, and then it'll be on the 13th it will have moved over and closer to Mars. So get your binoculars out and try and identify those planets by, first of all, finding the moon. The Venus and Mercury are going to be quite close together on the 22nd. They're just going to be over 1 degree apart. So that's 2 moon widths or so. So reasonably close. So Venus you can't miss. Mercury not so easy to pick up, and you might not be quite so confident. But if you go out on the 22nd, you'll find something very bright quite close to Venus, and that will be Mercury. And on the 24th, another aid to finding Mercury is the thin crescent moon. So that will be a waxing crescent now. It'll come out as a thin crescent, and it'll be close to both Mercury and Venus on that day, the 24th, which also sees a comet. Now, this is a telescopic object comet. It's called T2 Pan-STARRS. That's the instrument that discovered it. But that will be close to a couple of Messier objects, M81 and M82. So if you've got a good star map that shows you where those are, and they're in the, if you like, the front shoulders of the Great Bear, they'd just be above the front shoulders near the neck. So it'll be good to see those galaxies reasonably close to this comet. Another Messier object features on the 27th, and that's M44, the beehive, which is in Cancer, and that's to be found between Gemini, the twins, and Leo, the constellation of the month. So the moon is just a few degrees away from that little cluster, the beehive. Lastly, on May the 29th, there's what we call a clair obscur effect, which give us the lunar X and the lunar V on the moon. Now, clair obscur means, well, effectively light and shadows. It's just the effect the sunlight, the rising sunlight, has on the some craters along the terminator. That's the line between night and day on the moon. And as it hits the crater walls and illuminates them, some parts are still in darkness, some are bright, and so it gives us this apparent letter X and also a letter V. So get your small telescope or binoculars, look along that terminator, remember that's the line between night and day, and see if you can find these clair obscur effects. And on the same day, the 27th, we can also see the lunar X and lunar V. Now, this is a clair obscur effect. In other words, the light and shadows means that some craters seem to give us this this shape of a letter X, and elsewhere the lunar V. Get your binoculars out and run them up and down the moon's terminator. Now that's the line between night and day on the moon, and that's where you'll find these shadows forming an X and a V. Now, of course, I would normally be talking about meetings at local societies here, but because of COVID-19, clearly there aren't any meetings. So in the slides that support this talk, I've got the websites of those societies that people might like to look at to see any items of interest, postings of interest, and when they think their meetings might perhaps start. However, we can do some armchair astronomy, that's for the sky at night, watching on television. And it's the 800th episode of The Sky at Night. I think that's the longest running programme of its type in the world. Started, of course, by Patrick Moore way back in 57, I think it was. So the BBC's literature for that says the anniversary is marked by a back-to-basics lesson in practical astronomy. Topics include the dimming of Betelgeuse, how to observe meteor showers, and spotting bright Venus. Plus, there's a look back at Patrick Moore's stargazing techniques, a beginner's guide to the Messier catalogue of celestial targets, the latest from the Mars InSight mission, and how to get started in astrophotography. So the first broadcast of that is Sunday the 10th of May on BBC 4 at 10 p.m. in the evening. And on Thursday, also evening, 7:30, BBC 4 again, that's Thursday the 14th of May. And that, folks, concludes my look at what's up in the night sky for May.
Thank you, John, for the fascinating insight. This show will be repeated on Monday night at 11 p.m. and is available after transmission as a podcast. The podcast will also have more items in that we couldn't fit into the broadcast.
Stars Over Surrey with Dave Jamatis and John Extell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.